Here I am working with technology. So we have a PowerPoint, that's good. And we have this, I was just thinking, Robin, either you're clairvoyant or you know the song leader well that's going to do the invitation song.
Yeah.
You do indeed. Okay. Does Kelly know him as well?
She's seen him before. So.
Okay. good evening, everybody. I was hoping that maybe my announced topic this morning would at least be a little intriguing to you. The title here is Next Year in Jerusalem, but what I'm going to do is spend a little bit of time talking about the ancient and the modern land of Israel and what the Bible might have to say about this. Now, I realize some of this is history, some of this is politics, not American politics, of course, is Israeli or Palestinian politics, and some of it is the Bible. But let's do a little bit of background to begin with. You are probably aware that the land of Israel, as it is today, is disputed territory, that Israelis and Palestinians both feel like they ought to be in control of the land. So I've got here the flag of Israel. That would be the Star of David on the flag. It's a very pretty flag, I think. As you probably also know, at this point anyway, the Israelis have been in charge or been in control of the land of Israel really since 1949, which is actually over 75, 78, something like that years. Do the math. Here is a map of modern Israel. Those of us who preach and teach in biblical subjects are accustomed to looking at the old-fashioned maps of Israel, right? The ones that would have David's kingdom or Solomon's kingdom. Now, the one that I've got here indicates, however, Palestinian-held land and Israeli-held land. You can see in what I would call maybe a tan or a light brown, that would be Israel. And you can also see that Palestinians have control over some other parts, what they call the West Bank, which would be west of the Jordan River, and then also down in Gaza, which is the green part down in the far south west of the land. You'll notice that Palestinian hill territory is actually split apart with Israel in the middle, and so that's one of the challenges that they all face. This would be David Ben-Gurion, who would be the first prime minister of Israel back in 1949. A very courageous individual. He was originally from Europe, but he was one of those Jewish people who came in the 1930s or 40s to the land of Israel and began to homestead, to use the American term. And here is a Jewish family anywhere in the world, really, in America, in Europe, in Africa, or indeed in Israel, partaking of the Passover meal. You are aware, of course, the background of that, the angel passing over the doors with the blood on the doorposts and lintels back in the book of Exodus. And the last thing that they say in their celebration of the Passover is, next year in Jerusalem. And I guess what they really mean by that is that we hope that one day we can go see the city that is the iconic and central city for the Israelite people, right? Now, especially back in the days when Jerusalem was not held by Israelites or Israelis, to use a modern term, that would be a very wistful saying, next year in Jerusalem. Now, if we can go back to some of the history that we are facing, some reflections here. There were great expectations of the Messiah coming, even in Jesus' day. They were hoping, they were longing, they were poring over Bible passages, hoping to find clues as to who he would be. Mostly, of course, they did not accept Jesus as Messiah. Some Jews did. A fellow named Saul of Tarsus would be one of those, but most of them did not. The reason they did not accept Jesus as their Messiah probably is because they are expecting a David-like hero, somebody who would be a military fighter and throw off the Romans and take over the land. I don't know what our heroes would be, but I'm picturing us thinking, well, you know, he might be like a mix between Spider-Man and Superman or something like that. Well, David was all that, and Jesus, as you are probably aware, was not. In AD 66, you perhaps could remember that Jesus died in AD 33, so this would be almost a generation later. In AD 66, the Jews revolted against Rome. They thought it was time. They were desperate enough. I don't know what reasons they might have had, because from a historical standpoint, I think we'd all kind of roll our eyes and say, really? Jews? I mean, anybody, the French, the Africans, the Greeks, anybody who revolts against Rome gets the same result, right? The Roman legions come in, they take care of business, and once again, you're a part of the empire of the Romans. That's the way this is going to end too. Interestingly, Jesus actually predicted that this would happen. If you would read with me Matthew 24, beginning with verse 15. Matthew 24, 15. This is part of a longer discussion, of course, but he says, so when you see the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let the one who is in the housetop not go down to take what is in the house. And let the one who is in the field not turn back to take his cloak. And alas for the women who are pregnant and for those who are nurturing infants in those days, pray that your flight may be not be in winter or on the Sabbath. For then there should be great tribulation, such as has not been from the beginning of the world until now, and never will be. Now, part of what goes behind this, if I can back up and say and read chapter 24, verse 3. Verse 1, Jesus left the temple and was going away when his disciples came to point out to him the buildings of the temple. But he answered them, you see all these, do you not? Truly I say to you, there shall not be left there one stone upon another that will not be thrown down. Now, that was an astonishing statement. They're out there looking at the beautiful state buildings of the Jewish people, the temple and so on. And apparently with some civic pride, the apostles say, do you see all of that, Jesus? And Jesus says, you know, it's all going to be torn down. Now, the description of the earlier passage that I read was Jesus saying, when you see these signs coming, get out of town. If you're out already in the field, just keep going. And if you're up on the roof of the house, remember ancient houses in Israel would have a roof with a flat top and then stairs on the outside. He says, don't go inside. Go down those stairs and get out. He says, I feel sorry for pregnant women or people carrying little children and that kind of thing. Interestingly, in history, it says that when the Romans surrounded the city of Jerusalem, that the Jewish people said, God will take care of us. We'll be okay. In some miraculous way, God will throw away the Romans from us. The Christians said, ooh, that's what Jesus told us about. And they fled. And so the people who survived this cataclysmic event were the Christians, Jewish Christians, and the ones who did not survive would be the ones Jewish in faith as well as Jewish in expression. If I can just pause to make an observation, often when you read people, historians, commentators in the Bible and the like, they might say something like, oh, the Jews got their just deserts. Can I just say that the oldest and most despicable form of racism there is anti-Semitism? I am not going to claim that the tragedy of AD 70 was anything the Jews brought on themselves. I'm going to say this is one of the saddest moments in history, and I feel really, really, really sorry for a people who left their land. And left their city and left their culture wondered if they would ever get back. In fact, it took 2,000 years for that to occur. And I think that's an extraordinary thing. In AD 70, Vespasian, he would be the Roman general, destroyed Jerusalem, especially the temple of God on Mount Zion. One of those interesting side notes is they had captured a Jewish fellow named Josephus, and they had made him into their intelligence officer. And so what Vespasian said to Josephus is, how do we break the Jews' heart? We don't want them to ever do this again, to revolt against us. And Josephus quite rightly said, destroy their temple. And so the Romans did. They just went up to the temple and pulled all the stones down and made it a heap. And that's exactly, of course, what Jesus said would happen, right? Now, we skip 2,000 years, almost, to 1900, Jewish people began to return to what was then known as Palestine. For almost 2,000 years, Arabic-speaking people known as Palestinians had lived in the land. So Jewish people had not. Now they begin to come back. It's the history people refer to as the Aliyah, the uprising. But they begin to pour into Palestine. You say, why did they do that? Probably because of the treatment of Jewish people in Europe, especially in Poland and Russia and places like that, where the pogroms and the persecution of Jews and that kind of thing. Has anybody ever seen Fiddler on the Roof, that classic movie? That certainly depicts it. But the idea that I have here is that finally many Jewish people said, let's go to the land of Israel. Let's go back there and make our own lives there. They made a desert bloom. They came into a land that was semi-arid and dusty and unproductive. And they told people there, we'll buy the stoniest, most arid land you've got. And they bought it. And then they made the desert bloom. They planted vineyards, they planted orchards, they planted wheat fields. They fixed it up and made the desert bloom because this land had previously been unproductive. They suddenly made Israel a major producer of fruit and vegetables and the like. Many Jews were convinced that they could no longer trust the nations to protect them. Back in Europe and the like, people would say, well, we don't want to persecute anybody. But as it turned out, they did. Of course, I won't go into the history of the Holocaust when Nazi Germany tried to wipe out Judaism in the entire continent. Something like 5 million Jewish people perished. And that certainly did convince many Jewish people to say, we got to go back to Israel. And at least, if other people don't like us, we will have our own rulers and our own police and our own army, and we can protect ourselves. And so they begin to flow, especially after World War II, back towards the land of Israel. Of course, it was disputed. Palestinians were there. And of course, there'd be this argument to say, who should be there, Palestinians or Israelis? And that was at least the beginning of that. In 1949, they had Jewish independence. They had lived in the land since 1900, many of them, and more of them, of course, pouring out of Europe after the disasters of World War II, coming into the land of Israel until the majority of the residents of the land of Israel would be Jewish, not Arabic. And then in 1949, they declared independence. What happened is that they fought from Tel Aviv, went up the ridges, the mountains, into the city of Jerusalem, and took over the city of Jerusalem. I've read some of the accounts where Israeli soldiers stood on the Temple Mount, the place where David and Solomon and others had worshipped, and these tough, gritty Israeli soldiers fell to their knees and wept because they were back in their own land. Now, I have a resonant feeling for that. I don't mean to be unfeeling for the other peoples of the land, the Palestinians, but the Jews have been there a long time, right? Joshua, David, Solomon, and Jesus, and the like. I noted there that it's the only democracy in the Middle East. I think that's pretty fair to say. In Israel, you got newspapers and TV that criticize the president or the prime minister, that question people, that investigate stuff. You got opposition parties questioning what the president is doing. It's a real democracy, and every 4 years they get to vote. And if they don't like the current ruler, they can elect him out. That is not a privilege, of course, that most Arabic countries can claim. You ask a question, at least I ask a question there. Okay, who should be in a land? Palestinians or Jewish people, or Israelis, if you please. Who deserves to be in there? And somebody says, maybe the people who were there first. So I threw up some ideas. You guys, we'll all have to leave America. Because I don't know anybody out here, Native American. Some of you may have, 164th, 122nd, right? No, you're not real Native Americans. Bye-bye. See you back in Scotland or England or whatever. I'm being facetious to make a point. Really? You want to do that? In Southern Africa, they all say, African people, black people, Bantu people should be there. Actually, the Bushmen, the San, were there before them. So black people and white people have to leave Southern Africa, right? Now, what about the Aborigines in Australia? Should all the Australians leave except for the Aborigines? I'm not suggesting that everybody was free and fair and wonderful in the treatment of each other. I'm just saying it is a little crazy to say, I got here, what about the USA? Should this go from the USA to USC? United States of the Cherokee? I'm being facetious just to make a point. What about Israel, and why should Israel be the one where supposedly the original people were there? In fact, let's make a point about that. Go back to Genesis 16, beginning with verse 11. Genesis 16, 11. Now, what you've got here is, of course, two sons of Abraham. They're in the land of Canaan, or the land of Israel, if you please, now. And there they are sojourning. And we learn this. The angel of the Lord said to her, "Behold, you are pregnant. This will be Hagar, and shall bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, because the Lord has listened to your affliction. He will be a wild donkey of a man, his hand against everyone, and everyone's hand against him. And he shall dwell over against all his kinsmen." So the biblical history says that there are two sons of Abraham, Ishmael and Isaac, and that they would both become the fathers of two great ethnic groups. Ishmael, the father of the Arab people, and of course Isaac, the father of the Jewish people. So the first thing that dawns on us is, this very long-standing conflict, they're brothers, right? They're brothers to each other. And then the second thing is, it goes back a long, long way. We're talking about four millennia. And I think that's probably something to remember as well. This goes back a long way. But then notice the third thing. Abraham is a sojourner in somebody else's land. So neither Ishmael nor Isaac is an original inhabitant of the land of Canaan. Who is in the land of Canaan? Canaanites. I'm not being funny now. I'm just saying there was already cities and towns and villages and farms in the land of Canaan before the people of either the Arabs or the Israelis were there. And maybe that would give us a little bit of perspective on it. I do not know who the Canaanites would be today. I don't know that they have survived the millennia, but I'm just suggesting that that is a fact. I've got here two kinds of Jews in the land of Israel. Orthodox Jews still follow the Old Testament way. They wear the well-known, the yarmulke and the clothing, and they follow the Torah and that kind of thing. And secular Jews who are, I suppose, like secular Americans. They don't go to church or to Sabbath. They don't read the Bible, their Old Testament. They just live their lives as, regular Western people might do. The Jews believe only in the Old Testament. They didn't call it the Old Testament because they think there's only one Testament. But anyway, that's what they believe in. This should be a picture of an Israeli soldier. I think it's fair to say that man for man, the best soldiers on earth are Israelis. Now, America may have more resources and more technology, but if you needed somebody to rescue you, I would say get me about five Israeli soldiers, men or women, doesn't matter. They'll take care of business. They have to be good. They have to be excellent. The Israelis have a statement. We lose one battle, we've lost our country. And that really is a reality. Here would be the other side, of course, Palestinians, the other inhabitants of the land. Now, from a political standpoint, I think that maybe both nations have a right to have a land of their own, and they should probably find some way to partition the land of Israel, calling one Palestine, the other Israel. I imagine also that the city of Jerusalem should somehow be divided a little bit so that, Palestinians, Islamic people, and Jewish people can have a little bit of the ancient city for themselves. One of the interesting things is the Dome of the Rock, Islam's third most valuable holy site, is right there on the Temple Mount. Why they chose to put their third holiest mosque on the Temple Mount where Solomon's temple was, right? Where Herod's temple was. Why did they choose that? That was surely provocative, I would have thought. Anyway, that's the way it is. So my thought is that probably they should share. Speaking to Israelis and Palestinians for a little bit, it becomes clear to me that they both have a winner-takes-all attitude. In other words, the Palestinians say, well, we'd like to just have the whole country. And the Israelis would say, well, we'd like to have the whole country. So that would be the other solution. Somebody steps on the other person. Here is the Dome of the Rock, that golden colored structure there. You can see the wall in the foreground, which should be the wall that the Jewish people built and then was reinforced by the people in the 11th and 12th century during the Crusades. So it's built there right along the where the land drops off in a cliff into the Kidron Valley. Now, my thoughts is, okay, what does the Bible say about this entire situation? First of all, yes, Jesus is Messiah. The Jewish people missed that. That is their heartbreak. I'm not suggesting they lost their land because they did not accept Jesus. I'm suggesting that they won't see eternal bliss in heaven with Jesus because they rejected him. That's a far more serious thing. Wouldn't you agree? Right? So Matthew 16 and verse 18, though you could probably quote this one pretty effectively. Matthew 16, 18, Matthew 16, 16, Peter replied, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered, "Blessed are you, Simon, Bar-Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Yes, Jesus was the Son of God. Most of the Israelite people missed that fact. Chapter 17 and verse 5. This is on the Mount of Transfiguration. Moses and Elijah are with Jesus and three of the apostles. It says, "He was still speaking when, behold, a bright light overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, 'This is my beloved Son with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him.'" Here again, the declaration that Jesus was the Son of God. Jesus promised a spiritual kingdom in John chapter 18 and verse 36. This would be Pilate querying Jesus at his trial. He says, "Are you a king?" Pardon me. And Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." So when Jesus comes, the real Messiah, it is a spiritual kingdom, not a earthly or physical one. Probably one of the reasons why the Jews missed that, because as I say, they were looking for a heroic David-like figure, not a suffering servant like Jesus was. And then perhaps we should think in terms of the new covenant. Find if you would Jeremiah 31. Jeremiah 31. And I'll start with verse 31. "Behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant I made with their fathers on the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is a covenant I will make with the house of Israel after those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them. I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God, and they will be my people." Certainly, even in the Old Testament anticipated a new covenant, a new deal with Jesus Christ. I could read several of these others, but what I want to do is to read the passage in Galatians 6 and verse 16. Galatians chapter 6 verse 16, which is not on the slide there. The Apostle Paul says something very interesting about this. "And as for all who walk by the rule, peace and mercy be upon God and upon the Israel of God." My suggestion is that the Israel of God today would be Christians, and that the group called Christians could include certainly Jewish people and Gentile people, and in fact does, but this is the new people of God. Now, there's a couple of reasons why I'm saying this. One of them is that evangelical churches, and if you listen to radio and TV on those religious programs, they are absolutely obsessed with this thing. And their idea is that Temple Mount on the top of Jerusalem is going to become a new temple, and Jesus will come again and reign for 1,000 years, and all those kinds of things. But I'd like to suggest that the people of God, the Israel of God, are already present and accounted for. And we are a part of that, you and I. Yeah, that's an ancient battle. The battle between Israelis and Palestinians, or Arabs and Jews, or between Isaac and Ishmael. Ancient battle. There's more ancient battle even than that. You know what that is? The battle between God and Satan. And right now, the Lord is fighting that battle for your heart and your mind, maybe even as you sit there. Maybe Satan is trying to call for your attention as well, and he's trying to say, come follow me. That's the one you should worry about. This Israeli thing is a political question and not a theological question at all. Who deserves to be in the land of Israel? Who deserves to live there? Well, why, everybody who is a resident there, I would say. Who deserves to call themselves Palestinians or Israelis? They can figure it out. They may do so one day. Who deserves to be a member of the kingdom of God? Well, you can become that member even tonight. You can be buried with Jesus in baptism and claim your stake with Jesus. That will make you a part of the greatest and most eternal kingdom in history. Would you like to do that? I ask you to think about that and come as we stand, as we sing.